Section and exception of Yevastar has always been a very jarring one, a very provocative, a difficult passage to understand. Yiddishkeit in no way suppresses human sexuality. If anything, it sanctifies it. Part of healthy lifestyle. It's a gift that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us to create family, to create kinship, to find the person that you will partner with in life and communicate with that spouse in a way that goes beyond words, in a very constructive and very sacred fashion. And this whole scene of first of all, intercourse with a Gentile, which, aside from the formal Avera, it just feels so, such a betrayal of everything Jewish. There are so many different perspectives on how Judaism interacts with the Gentile world and Gentile culture and Gentile information and Gentile needs. And it's a healthy, robust, and vital question. And there are different balances and different approaches. Some are more insular, some are more universal. But the notion of something so private and something so, such a deep part of our identity, such a core aspect of our identity, that would tend to be something that should be national and internal and part of historical connectivity and membership rather than almost betraying your identity and your historical affiliation. And that's why it's just so jarring, the whole notion of intermarriage. Not just from a halachic standpoint, not just because of the connotations, because it just seems like such a forfeiture of Jewish identity. And it's not just the intercourse with a Gentile, but it's also, it seems to be, and as Rashi says, Dibur Torah Keneged Yetzirah, it seems to be halacha accommodating, a very menial and crass, common but very vulgar human need, rather than disciplining against it and governing against it. And so much of religious identity is transcending bestial, fleshly needs and purifying ourselves, even under times of duress and times of stress. So it's obviously a very, very sensitive and complicated or complex conversation. But within this, and within the framework of Yevastar, there's a fascinating Rambam. The Torah describes the process of her entering the family of her conqueror, of the person who admitted her during war. And there's a machlokus in the Tanoim about whether only one bias mutter or multiple bias mutter before she gets married and possibly converts. It's a very, very complex set of halachos governing a Yifas Torah. Most shittos don't allow wanton, unrestricted sexual encounter. So there's a process, whether it predates the first bia or succeeds the first bia. But astonishingly, part of this process is described as not just removing her clothing of captivity and replacing them with clothing that are more respectful and more dignified, but she cries, she's given at least a month to cry for her parents. Now, this is something which we would expect to occur naturally, and any decent, civilized human being should extend that opportunity to her. Crying is a basic sign of grief and of loss and of coping. And why does the Torah have to instruct it as if it's part of the process? So the Rabban quotes two other positions before he delivers his own assertion. His first position is in order for her to become less attractive, and there's an attempt for her to grow her nails, and especially after the first bia, there's a sense of trying to diminish the sexual attraction so that it doesn't become addictive, it doesn't become an intoxication. So part of that is her immersed in a month-long grief, crying, sadness, and potentially less physical beautification, less physical enhancement. And this is a chance again to diminish the sexual attraction, which had expressed itself so powerfully, but in ways that are so inappropriate. And others claim that this is just to show compassion, he quotes Ibn Ezra, not necessarily to make her more or less attractive, but just to allow her to cry and to grieve. It's just basic humanitarian response, basic pity and sympathy. Rabban has a third definition. And his third definition is based on the Gemara in Nedarim, very loosely. The Gemara in Nedarim talks about a man and his wife, and it talks about the conditions under which sexual intercourse is inappropriate. The Gemara talks about, let me find the exact case and count them down, because there's an acronym that refers that the Gemara alludes to. The Gemara quotes a pasuk in Yechezkel, referring to people that are rebels, Mardim and Poshim. And Rabbi Levi, the great Darshan, said this refers to people that have nine forms of inappropriate sexual encounter. By and large, without getting into all nine refer not to inappropriate physical encounter, but sexual encounter without an appropriate mental state or emotional state. So for example, B'nai Ema, where the woman is afraid of the man, or B'nai Sinua, where there's hatred between the two rather than camaraderie and affection. God forbid B'nai Timura, where the man is conjuring up images of another woman while interacting with his wife. Where the man is drunk, B'nai Shichrus, where he's not cognitively intact sufficiently to experience sexuality emotionally. Gushas Halev, where the man has already decided to divorce his wife, and again, there isn't the requisite affection and friendship that should frame Bia. Now, of course, many medievalists, the Ravid and the Ramban, and we'll mention the Ramban in a moment, they read deep Kabbalistic import into the mentality during sexual intercourse, and at the very least, the mentality would affect the quality and the caliber of the children. So if the thought process was sacred, and in many cases it was literally sacred, not just the general sanctity of sexuality, but realizing that you are involved in an act of creation and focusing and channeling all those thoughts and all the inner piety towards creating children in a way that probably would be very dissimilar to our own mores, and at least in many worlds, our own mores and our own expectations of sexuality, the children would be affected by the sanctity of thought and the sanctity of intention. And all these types of interactions would taint that sanctity and thereby taint or adulterate the mental input and thereby in some way enable or not enable but produce defective offspring. Most of us, at least outside of the Hasidic world, don't try to superimpose that type of sanctity into our thought process during our sexual encounter. And for that reason, we don't read the last couple Se'ifim and Shulchan Aruch that literally in terms of how we experience. Our experiences in sexuality are more or less based on some of the very healthy and common associations in the modern world, friendship and love and romance and soulmate and bonding and in a healthy way. But even for us, the Gemara Nedarim resonates very deeply. And it reminds us that sexuality outside of the framework of camaraderie, friendship, partnership, marriage is vulgar, is crass, is one of the great, great prices we pay for a hyper-sexed world, and in even a world in which pornography has permeated so many different nooks and crannies of our experiences. It's not just the addiction and the sapping of resources, and of course the yisurim that pornography exacts from us, but it's our whole view of sexuality. And without elaborating more, because these are not things we elaborate that often unless we speak about it in intimate settings, one-on-one, Rebbe and Talmud, it's not something for, so to speak, public consumption, but sexuality is a very powerful force, and it's meant to be used as a tool to produce family, to produce the strength of a partnership, to produce joy and intimacy between two people. So that. So there's a frame that's necessary for healthy sexuality, and then there's also a larger ends for which sexuality is a means, so that the bonds and the emotional bonds are strengthened, and the marriages can be robust and deep and profound. And when that's missing, either because there's no emotion, it's just sheer, as people say, eye candy, personal enjoyment without any framework, or when the framework is adulterated by all these inappropriate thoughts of hatred and fear, God forbid. So sexuality just becomes very bestial, very subhuman, very animalistic. And the Ramban suggests that that's what's happening in Parshas Ki Tetzeh. Even though this isn't classic marital sexuality, it's still a form of sexuality that has to cohere. And in some ways, this is what makes the Ramban so powerful. Even this allowance, which itself is problematic and carefully governed and carefully legislated, even that has to be contextualized within some level of emotional bonding. And if the woman's heart is completely torn and completely split because, completely wrecked because of the loss of her father or her parents in war, and then this Jewish male would impose himself and thrust himself upon this woman sexually, to be in some ways rape, and the Torah can't pardon or can't validate rape. There has to be some connection, some emotional bond at some level between the two parties. And similarly, if she's still affiliated with the world of paganism, and that should create very, very powerful emotional wedge between a man committed to monotheism and this woman who's still deeply culturally affiliated with the world of paganism, that barrier, even without the Kabbalistic suggestions, which the Ramban really did believe in, that engaging sexual intercourse with a pagan inclined woman would somehow affect the constitution of the Jewish male and perhaps even the children of his seed. But even without those Kabbalistic elements, emotionally, there should be such a gap between a monotheistic and a paganistic person that it would render the sexual encounter pornographic and selfish and just crass. I remember once engaging in a conversation. I was interviewing in a high school for the yeshiva, and the principal told me that there was a boy who was struggling with issues of religion and faith. And obviously he wasn't a candidate for the yeshiva. Our yeshiva wouldn't have been appropriate for him at that stage. But the principal asked me to speak with the child and with the adolescent and try to walk him through some of his questions. So he began our conversation by asking me the following question. Could I defend the various sexual prohibitions, in this case he was talking about Negiah, without saying that it's the will of Hashem? And the premise of his question was, every red-blooded American boy, man feels these legitimate, healthy, heterosexual desires, and why shouldn't he act upon them? He's not committing anything grave, it's not dirty, it's not unholy, and why shouldn't he express them? And I responded to him as follows. I felt that any time you're deriving sexual pleasure from another human being, that's immoral, abusive behavior, that's objectification. And the fact that it's reciprocal doesn't make it less exploitative. I asked him, what would happen if I turned to you? I was sitting across the table from him. I said, what would happen if we made a deal that I would punch you if you punched me, or you punched me if I could punch you? We each inflict bodily harm on one another. Would the reciprocity make it any less abusive? So when there's a context to the sexuality, it's not just drawing pleasure, but it's creating bonds of intimacy that are based on emotional bonds that have been produced and are serving larger interests than sexuality serving a larger purpose. When it's absent of the prefix and without any yield, then it's just objectifying another body for pleasure, and then that's just very, very amoral and ugly behavior. And it takes a scenario such as Yifas Tohar for the Ramban to highlight. Even Yifas Tohar, which itself is an exceptional and anomalous, atypical sexual encounter, which itself is governed by various limitations. Even then, the Torah instructs, if she's grieving and there's no emotional bond, then even Yifas Tohar is prohibited. And if she's still engaged and loyal to a world of paganism, that should be something which is abhorrent to you, not just because this woman is engaged in a foreign world, though that as well, but because you're on such different emotional frequencies that sexuality has nothing more than prostitution, and prostitution cannot be countenanced, even in the framework of Yufastar. It's a fascinating and important Ramban, not just about, in some ways, moderating the abrasive nature of Yufastar, but more importantly, reminding us of our own sexual conduct, and as best as we can, to create sexual encounter as a product of a twinning of souls and deep emotional bonds. And obviously there's deep sexual instincts that shouldn't be ignored, because that would lead to healthy sexual pleasure and interaction, which is important for healthy and meaningful sexual interaction. But it can't be absent of the framework, of the emotional framework.